1490 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Police in Farmington, New Mexico, looking for a reason why a gunman opened fire, seemingly at random, in a neighborhood, killing three elderly women before being shot and killed by police.
We have come across some indication that potentially he had some mental health issues, and that's through interviews with involved parties in his life.
Deputy Chief Kyle Dowdy identifying the suspect as 18-year-old Bo Wilson. Missouri officials have terminated the Republican Attorney General's emergency rule that would have limited transgender care for minors and some adults. Republican Governor Mike Parson expected to sign a bill passed by the state legislature restricting transgender health care for minors. President Biden hosting congressional leaders, including Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer at the White House for talks on raising the debt limit. No deal reached yet.
We have to come to common ground. That's the only way this has ever gotten done. It has never gotten done with one party saying you have to do it my way.
House Speaker McCarthy says there could be a deal by the end of the week. This is ABC News. Two poultry workers in the UK have tested positive for bird flu. That nation's health security agency says the workers have no symptoms and there is no evidence of transmission between people. Lawmakers learning more about the rapidly growing field of artificial intelligence.
Democrat Richard Blumenthal chairs the Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law. He asked today about how AI programs like GPT-4 will affect the job market. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman responded,
GPT-4 will, I think, entirely automate away some jobs, and it will create new ones that we believe will be much better.
The hearing has also touched on how those tools could impact the economy, politics, and social discourse. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
Wells Fargo agreeing to pay $1 billion to settle a lawsuit filed by shareholders. They allege the bank made misleading statements about compliance with federal regulators after a fake account scandal. Andy Field, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matt-Nair. Here's what you need to know. Is kicker Mason Crosby's time over with the Green Bay Packers? There's speculation after Crosby's wife, Molly, tweeted at Simone Biles' announcement last week that her husband had signed with the team. Molly Crosby tweeted, quote, "We loved our time there and so will you. Let's talk coats, boots, custom Packer gear," unquote. The tweet has since been removed. In his 16 years with the team, the 38-year-old is the franchise leader in points and games played. Crosby is a free agent. The official 2023 Wisconsin State Highway map is out in print and online. This year's edition includes Wonders of Wisconsin, with information about updated Wisconsin welcome centers, updated census data, Amtrak service, and more. Get a free copy at Wisconsin Rest and Welcome Centers or order one online at travelwisconsin.com. I'm Jane Matt-Nair. This is Civic Media News.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check NHTSA.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at NHTSA.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hey, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out. Because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
If I could be you...
And you could be me...
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way...
To get inside...
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, I am 100% in line with Brian's thinking of, you know, one of the reasons that people are afraid of what's coming is we've got virtually no social safety net. That's a problem. It really, really is a problem. Let's quick go to the phone lines. I've got Steve from Chicago on line one. Steve, what's on your mind, brother?
Yes, I wanted to make a couple of points with regard to higher education. One, I think that it's a mistake to try and quantify it in terms of what it costs you and then also what it's worth to you in terms of career advancement and social mobility. The purpose of higher education is to educate you, is to hopefully produce a better human being, a better citizen, a more informed voter, these sorts of things.
I agree.
So sometimes I become a little bit frustrated when people want to reduce it to, all right, what does it mean to me in terms of a starting salary and where will I be in a 401k plan 15 years down the road? So that's point number one. Point number two, despite its increasing costs, I mean, and you'll hear all these crazy stories about people who owe a couple of $100,000 with a fine arts degree from Harvard. Yes, that's possible. The averages are very different. It's about $26,000 for a public school education these days, a little over $31,000 for a private school education in terms of student loan debt that you take on. So it's not the end of the world. Over a lifetime, the average additional benefit from a college education four-year degree is over $1 million. With a master's degree, it's almost $2 million. A PhD, a professional degree, can go from $3 to $5 to $7 million of additional benefit. Beyond that, let's face it. Anybody who's got a college degree knows, you know what? If you date, chances are that you're going to end up dating somebody who also has a college degree and marrying them. And then so now you've got two people with a much higher earning potential. Your social network tends to improve if that's the kind of thing that matters. There's all sorts of benefits to higher education that extend beyond simply, you know, again, the bottom line.
Don't disagree with you, Steve.
I understand why there's a frustration. Higher education should not cost what it does in this country, absolutely. At the same time, it is still, on average, a huge benefit for you going forward. You know, let's face it, you might be a really bright person out of high school, and you might be really committed and might be a great guy for a job. The fact is that if you don't have that degree on your resume, no one's ever going to see your resume in today's day and age. There's just two piles, people with them and without them. There are jobs you are never going to get to see. And let's face it, that college degree gets you your first job. Maybe
right, but here's the thing, Steve, and this
beyond
is where
that,
my point has always been, and my point with Biden saying that we need to have a pathway to the middle class that working people can get to without a college degree, because not everyone is cut out to go to college. I wasn't cut out to go after high school. I eventually went on, got my bachelor's and a master's and all that. But, you know, right out of school, I had no business going. There should have been other pathways, but I was told, and this was the point,
that the only path to the middle class is going to be with that college education. And that shouldn't be the only way. That was our point, Steve. So, but I appreciate the thoughts because you're not wrong.
And you're absolutely right. And we need to invest in things like trade schools and other things. There are plumbers who make more than doctors.
Yep.
But again, you can be a well-employed plumber making a lot of money, but that doesn't mean you understand Plato's Republic. And it's essential that we do because we don't have enough people who do, and they go out and cast votes. And
amen.
That's a problem.
Thank you, Steve. Perfectly put. Thanks so much. The best line that I've ever heard is, you know, when you're walking a dog, you can see all the beautiful things around you, and you can appreciate different things, and you can, you know, filter different things. Without a degree, you don't know who's walking who. That was one of the better ways I've heard it put. Anyway, but for me, this still comes back to, and as I've said, it's about building worker power so that there are more pathways to the middle class than just, hey, I've got to get this piece of paper. And here to share some thoughts on how we build that worker power and ensure that work is rewarded. Because as I said a minute ago, for every president of my lifetime, my wish for them is to return reward to work. That's why I've asked Dan Kane Jr. to come talk with us. Dan is an International Brotherhood of Teamsters trustee, also the president of Local 202 Teamsters in New York City. Dan, thanks for taking time for us. I didn't lose him. Appreciate the time, Dan. Thanks so much.
Hey, how are you?
I am good. So, you know, we've been talking about this pathway to the middle class and this idea of workers having the power to earn a good living, to be able to not have to work two or three jobs. And I think it's an important moment to be having this discussion, which is why we asked you to come and share some thoughts as we're being just basically torn apart. You know, and I know you representing workers in New York, that building power is really important to you.
Yes. You know, I just a little background on the workers that I do represent. We got an amalgamated local of 4,000 people, but the largest bargaining unit is the one that I came from as a teenager. I started there a very, very long time ago. But it's the biggest produce market in the world, and it's in the poorest urban congressional district in the country. So it's a lifeline not only for the city's food supply, but it's also a lifeline for people to have a decent job, to be able to work one job and earn a living that gives people hope.
And dignity. And dignity and respect and all those things that come along with it, right?
Yeah. You know, most workers, you know, they see their dreams in their children's eyes. So what they want is a platform to build from. So when people are, and this is my experience as in my family, coming from very, very, let's just say modest beginnings, that if somebody can have a steady job, that is a halfway decent job that has health insurance, has some way to retire with some dignity, and has a sort of a structure to it, a work week, a place to be. Those folks can build a life that can give their children hope for a better tomorrow. And that's been the experience of American workers in the labor movement. But they've had to organize and fight for that place in our society. So,
no, it's been my experience, Dan. Look, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. The first person I ever remember to get a union job was the neighbor who got a job at Ford, a UAW job, and immediately you saw their lives get better. They had food at the end of the month. Kids had better clothes. They eventually got a secondhand car. They eventually moved out. Life got better. So at a young age, union job, better life was the frame. But sadly, over the last, you know, 40, 50 years, we've seen an attack on organized workers to the point to where we've pitted each other against each other, to where we're ripping each other apart and throwing new gimmicks out. And, you know, we started off talking about the AB5 out of California and, you know, this idea of, you know, misclassifying workers as independent contractors or, hey, you're your own boss. And how this is tearing apart at worker power and tearing apart our ability to organize to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and opportunities.
Yeah, I think there's been a I see some hope in that some of that is changing and that people are I think the statistics today are a vast majority of the people, if they could form or join a union without the harassment from their employer, they would. And our on our the labor movement as a whole is enjoying good public support, but you couldn't tell by the numbers that we have,
right?
Because the issues that we do stand for, most workers stand for. We're just in a system that has, for example, one of the tactics that you just raised is used to divide workers, misclassify employees as subcontractors because employers have less obligations to subcontractors. So in order to lessen their obligations and put those obligations onto the workers, they'll come up with very, very inventive ways to say, you're not a worker, you're an entrepreneur. You know, we allow you to own the truck, and you can take all the risk that goes with it. And they do it in many, many different workplaces, not right. just transportation. But all it is a gimmick to try to get under or out of the limited statutory obligations that employers have to employees. So, and that's just one example. There's lots of them.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said if it was good for you, they wouldn't let you do it. You know, they understand that this benefits them because it keeps us, you know, look, you know, the old Jay Gould quote that's been credited to him. You could pay half the working class to murder the other half. We're just doing it in a much more civilized way with titles and fake names.
Yeah, I don't think that people somehow understand that work and your relationship to the rest of the workers, not just in your workplace, but in workers in general, because there are only two types of people in the world, right? People who work for a living and people who make money off people who work.
Exactly.
So once we identify that I'm very similar to the worker who works in a fast food environment. You know, I often say to people, well, you have a decent job. You made $80,000, $90,000. Yeah, you did. But you are still much more in line with the worker who makes $30,000 or the unemployed person who is struggling than you are with a millionaire. Matter of fact, statistically, you are much closer. Just use the numbers. You're $80,000 closer to the person who's unemployed, and you're $920,000 away from the millionaire. Somehow, we have to get people to identify that they have much more in common with each other than they don't.
Yeah, but we're in this Hunger Games scenario, Dan. I mean, the reality is you know, I love the cartoon of, you know, there's a plate of cookies and, you know, one guy takes 10 of them and he tells the other two guys, hey, that guy's going to take your cookie. That makes sense to me because that's the economy that we've been living in because we have been so divided and told, hey, we got to go get ours. And that's by design. I mean, it wasn't always that way. My grandparents' generation didn't think that way. They came back from World War II. They fought fascism overseas, and they went to the shop floor to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities, not just for themselves, but for their kids and their grandkids, you know, something that I've benefited from.
They also lived through the Great Depression, and that changed them, utterly changed how they looked at others, how they looked at poor people. We don't identify. Matter of fact, most people will identify themselves as middle class, regardless of their income. Nobody poor has become a dirty word to be poor. We're dignified. We can see it in our common culture. You know, when I was a kid, there were two TV shows on television. One was The Waltons, and one was Good Times. One was an urban poor black family. One was a rural white family, but they were dignified and they had their own code of morality of how they treated people. They were decent people. And today that was what was on television when I was a little kid. But now if I turn the TV on, it's the lifestyles that are rich and famous and who has a bigger house. And so the culture has sort of morphed from identifying with people not by who they are or how they behave or the decency, the basic decency they have for each other, that's not lauded in our culture. What you have and own and who you happen to be in society has become the what we see around us. And I think it leaves a lot of people feeling less than.
Right.
And I think part of the resurgence of people having a positive feeling about the labor movement is a lot of the young people aren't buying into the lifestyles that originate. They're coming to realize that that's a hoax. And that gives me a little hope, because you see these young people that are, I had an experience with them. Two years ago, we had a pretty noteworthy strike at the produce market. It got a lot of press around the country, and we had a lot of young people come and help us who just came to the picket line. It was in the middle of COVID, or 9 months into COVID, and they came and helped, and they identified themselves with the produce workers, and they gave inspiration to the. I think they got inspiration from the workers, and the workers got inspiration from them.
Yeah, it's really about community. It's about those old school values that I hope we're rediscovering without having to go through a depression to get to it. Because my fear is the only way that we have this reuniting is through tragedy. And that's been kind of the experience, and I hope we don't have to do that again.
Yeah. Yes. I look. You know, struggle does change people, and maybe they see clearly when they see those kind of struggles. And I think some of these young people are seeing that because many of them, you know, take the idea of a higher education. It's a laudable goal. I mean, I was a working class kid. I went to school, community college, and then went to night school, all public institutions, right? If it wasn't for the, I'm a creature, I'm a descendant I'm the creation of the New Deal. I went to public schools, played in public parks, public roads, all infrastructure that was provided by the society for me to thrive. It wasn't because I was rich. It was because this was how you were going to live, you know, modestly, but you were going to have all of these things provided. And then you could use your hopes and aspirations and dreams to flourish. And it was a societal thing. I did have those things just by being. Just by showing up at the school, they opened the door. Somebody paid the taxes to do that. Somebody paid the taxes for the beach and the parks I went to with my friends. Those things are institutional and should not. And that's an idea. That's an idea. It didn't just happen. It was an idea of the society that we were going to fight and make sure that people had, that they had decent jobs, they had schools for their children to go to, they had decent neighborhoods to live in. That was a modern idea that came out of the 20th century.
And now let me ask you last line of questioning, because, you know, do you see us going back? I say we're going back 100 years. We're going back to the bad old days of the 80s and 90s, and not the 1980s and 90s. We're going back to the Lochner era. We're going back to the, hey, you're on your own kind of environment. Do you see us moving back to that place? Are we reliving that in this moment? I'm curious where you're at.
I think we have been living. We have a very cynical view of each other sometimes, you know. And yes, working class people can divide themselves over issues that, if you really asked everybody, said, okay, what are the things that are important to you? I think the four things that would be important to them would be, you know, to have a decent job, to be able to have health care in case they get sick, and to be able to retire with a little dignity, raise their families in decent communities. I think that's universal.
Yep.
I just think that we've taken our eye off that ball, that those are the things that we as a people, regardless of where we come from or what we look like, those are the values we should hold dear. And how do we get them? We have to have a little power in our society. And there's only two types of power. There's money and there's people. And, you know, and everyday ordinary people created that environment that I talked about from the New Deal. It wasn't created overnight. But everyday ordinary people can do miracles when they want to. When they struggle together, they do.
Yeah.
And they can lift people.
No, I'm with her.
I have a little bit of hope. I'm not. I'm not.
No, I love the hope. As I've said a million times, they may have all the money. We've out-procreated them. If only we would come together. That seems to be the message for this, and I think it's a very good one. Final thoughts, Dan? Any thoughts of any hope we're going in the right direction?
Well, you know, I'm in the Teamsters Union for 39 years. You're always struggling to move forward. I still get up every day to on that mission. On the mission to, hey, you know, regular ordinary people matter, and if the labor movement is not going to be the place to fight, who is going to do it? And I do see people doing it. I don't know if the social changes I'm talking about will come about in the same structures that we've had over 100 years.
Yeah,
but I do think that it'll be there because people will demand them. Now we'll go through periods of time. You know, our union is out there struggling with the largest bargaining agreement in the world, I believe, in the private sector, and we're fighting for a decent contract right now with 300,000 people. I think that's a miracle in a lot of ways, right? To have 300,000 people struggling with an employer to try to get some basis of decency at the workplace, that gives me hope. And when 10 people do it, it gives me hope. And maybe others will do it, join with us. And it's never going to come easy. Social change, I mean, whether it was the civil rights movement or the women's movement, I don't think any of that doesn't come easy. That's not just in the history book. That was fought for by people's blood, sweat, and tears. And I have to rise every day with a little bit of hope. Sometimes you get dejected, but I do think that people will come around.
I'm right there with you. Dan Kane, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. I look forward to having you back again and sharing some more down the road. And look, I hope those guys, those UPSers, get the contract that they earn. Appreciate the time, Dan.
Well, I know. President O'Brien and the rest of the executive board are working real hard at it, and the rest of the committee, which is a committee of representatives of the working class people that they represent. So we're struggling out there, but you know, a collective bargaining agreement is the fastest thing to the middle class, as you stated, but it's also the fairest work environment that I know of.
There you go. Dan, appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Dan Kane, international trustee for the Teamsters, also Teamsters Local 202 president. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Well, I evidently stepped on some toes on the higher ed thing. Look, I'm not against people going to college. I've got degrees. I know people who've got degrees. My point was very simple, if I need to clarify it. Work should be rewarded, and college isn't the only way. Should education be available to everyone? Yeah, that's why I'm a big proponent of public education, and why I've also said we need to expand the school year from K through 12 through K through 14 to get into a 2-year, be it your prerequisites for a 4-year degree, be it a trade, be it something, technology skills, whatever. Education is really important, and I'm 100% in that. I'm not advocating for people to be Neanderthals. We see what lack of education has done to us politically, and I'm on board 100% with the need for better critical thinking, better civics education, all of that stuff. The point was simply that for years I've been saying, look, the model that was shoved down my throat, that your only path, the only direction you can take is to go to college. There should be other avenues. And I find it refreshing that finally we're saying, look, there are other ways to make a living, and we should make those 100% possible. And we should make those available to people. I want people to be critical thinkers. I want people to be educated. I believe in the arts and the humanities and all of this stuff. And I want people to, I tell my kids all the time, the most important thing is learning how to learn. So as far as your education takes you, you're going to learn incredible amounts of things, but more importantly, you're going to learn how to learn so that you can adapt and adjust in the future. A well-rounded education is extraordinarily important. I can't emphasize that enough. But it shouldn't be the only way that every person has to pursue to be able to make a living. That's my point. Thanks for the emails, guys. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day we lost one of the giants of the U.S. labor movement, A. Philip Randolph. A. Philip Randolph spent his life working for black workers and the cause of labor. He organized the first national black union to be recognized by the American Federation of Labor, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. The fight for union recognition took 12 years, and the porters signed their first contract in 1937. Randolph went on to lead the effort to desegregate war industries and armed services during and after World War II. He was one of the leading organizers of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, one of the most memorable actions of the civil rights movement. He also worked tirelessly to break down discrimination within the labor movement. He was elected the first black vice president of the AFL-CIO in 1955. Randolph's dedication to the cause of labor was summed up when he said, quote, "The essence of trade unionism is social uplift. The labor movement has been the haven for the dispossessed, the despised, the neglected, the downtrodden, the poor." But Randolph also consistently declared that no movement for social justice can be complete unless it is also inclusive. While organizing for the desegregation of the war industries during World War II, Phillips argued, quote, "Equality is the heart and essence of democracy, freedom and justice, equality of opportunity in industry, in labor unions, schools and colleges, government, politics, and before the law. There must be no dual standard of justice, no dual rights, privileges, duties, or responsibilities of citizenship. No dual forms of freedom." Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Oftentimes, when you suspect you're being gouged by corporate price fixers, you are. Take the rat-a-tat-tat of today's price jumps at supermarkets and chain restaurants. They make you want to rush to the cash register before they raise prices again. "No, no," cried the CEOs of food giants. "It's not us. It's, quote, supply chain disruptions." Then corporate politicians and economists chime in with old platitudes about the invisible hand of supply and demand. And media know-nothings also pile on, blathering about ne'er-do-wells causing a labor shortage. But hogwash, your suspicions are right. It's plain old price-fixing by avaricious food monopolies. Top executives even brag about it when talking to their bankers and shareholders. McDonald's, for example, recently told investors that, quote, "strategic menu price increases in the past 3 months had boosted profits by 63%. Big Mac CEO exulted, "I'm really proud of how our system has executed pricing." Never mind that it's their customers being executed. Well, say free market proselytizers, just buy from a competitor. But in nearly all segments of today's food economy, a handful of giants control the market, with each one in on the fix. For example, Chipotle, a McDonald's rival, also jacked up prices in the same three-month period, manufacturing an 84% profit increase. Its CEO then gloated to Wall Streeters, "I think we've demonstrated we do have pricing power." This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, these same giants are also fattening their profits by ripping off their workers. The federal poverty level is now $25,000 a year, with fast food workers typically getting only $3,000 a year more than that bare minimum for a 40-hour week. But there's the gotcha. The profiteering executives hold each worker to about 26 hours a week, creating a sub-poverty labor force for this multi-billion-dollar industry.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the days are ticking down to the June 1st, I guess, is what Jen Yellen is saying, is the deadline, which who knows what happens after this. I mean, we've lived through some shutdowns in the past. And what usually happens is our government workers, they're the proverbial dog in this dysfunction. They're the ones who get kicked, either kicked to the curb or they show up. I don't know if they still show up and don't get paid, which is insane to me. I know they'll get paid down the road, but a lot of people, they need their paychecks now. Now, there are some reports, though, hey, talks are productive. You know, they're negotiating. This is ridiculous. There should be no negotiating. There shouldn't be this debt ceiling at all. The time, and this is simple, the time to debate spending before you spend the money. Just my thoughts. And here to share some thoughts on where we are and where things are potentially going to go, I've asked Daniel Horowitz to come talk with us. Daniel is the Deputy Director of Legislative Department at the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE, AFGE.org, their website, if you want to check out the work that they do. Daniel, thanks for taking time for us.
Always great to be on the show, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So where are we? I mean, you know, I'm in this position where I'm tired of this ticking bomb, this hostage situation every year, every couple of years, to where are we going to default? Are we going to screw over the economy? Are we going to make people go to work without being paid? I'm kind of tired of this already.
Well, if you're tired, how do you think federal workers feel? They feel much the same way. And it's all a result of our dysfunctional Congress that has existed for many years and seems to just get worse with each iteration. But the first point I think we need to make is what we're facing right now is very different from the somewhat frequent government shutdowns that we've had over the past 10, 20 years. The default is a horse of a different color, and it would really reach into every corner of American life. And its effects are not reversible. So right now, the ship is headed toward the iceberg. And if we don't change course in the next couple of weeks, I think people will wake up to what a default really means, and it will not be good.
No, it's insane to me. I mean, you look at some of the cuts that Republicans are talking about doing. And look, I know that in any negotiations, you put everything on the table. But the cuts they're proposing to the VA, for instance, which you have members that you represent at the VA, they're talking about a 22% cut, money that they spent to take care of veterans who are the victims of cancers from burn pits. They're talking about, you know, clawing a bunch of that back. It just seems that the cruelty doesn't know any bounds just so that they get their way. It's I don't know. It just seems mean-spirited.
The Republican blueprint, which is called the Limit, Save, Grow Act, others have called it the Default on America Act, is really mean-spirited, and it would even apply onerous requirements onto people who are receiving food stamps, getting about $2 a meal, which is hard to avoid starvation on $2 a meal. But Republicans would have additional work requirements just to get that $2. So it's a horrid bill. And part of what's at play here is the Republicans aren't saying where they would cut. So we say, well, it looks like this bill could cut 22% from veterans, for example, and say, oh, no, that isn't our intention. We'd never cut veterans. And they say we'd never cut defense. And this is why you need to see the whole plan in detail before you can form an opinion. But clearly, they are going to gut the government one way or another, whether it's the military, whether it's veterans, whether it's more likely the civilian side of the government, Homeland Security, all these other programs we depend on. Someone is going to have to pay under their plan, and it's going to be a huge bill. And it's not even going to accomplish their goal of balancing the budget, if that is their goal.
I don't believe their goal is balancing the budget, because when they're in power,
they cut taxes.
They don't. They, as you point out, they cut taxes. They cut taxes wildly on who? Not you or me, but the people who you know, breathe the rarefied air of our top 1%. This is where the frustration is. While we're talking about slicing and dicing working people, we're not talking about raising taxes on the very wealthy to pay for the things that we need. While down the road, it's looking like Social Security could see a massive cut in the next couple of years because we're not doing anything there. It just seems like the number of problems that they're creating, I don't know. It's just it's one after another. It doesn't seem to know any bounds.
Yeah, and here's the cynicism of their approach, and this is very revealing. In the Inflation Reduction Act, one provision gave the IRS more money. Now, IRS is not always the most popular agency, but we depend on them because we can't fund the government without them. The Trump-appointed IRS chief said we are losing $1 trillion a year to tax cheats, mainly the super rich, a lot of cryptocurrency traders. $1 trillion a year. That's much more money than the Republicans would recoup elsewhere. Do they want to go after that? Absolutely not. In fact, not only not beefing up IRS efforts, they're rescinding the money, the additional money that was given to the IRS under the Inflation Reduction Act. The Congressional Budget Office, nonpartisan, says that provision alone would cost $180 billion because IRS would become less effective. We'd have more cheating. So they don't care about the deficit. If they did care about it, if they cared about balancing the budget, they'd be strengthening the IRS.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's the pound of flesh that they, and it's coming out of working people. That's the frustrating part. And you pointed out, the food, the food money, $2 a meal. I don't know how you survive on that. But when I look at the massive tax breaks we're giving to people who don't necessarily need it to survive, it tells me priorities. And, the priority is in this moment to hold the country hostage so we can make the wealthy wealthier. Now, one of the things I get, Daniel, is, people are saying that they're concerned that China and Russia and India and Brazil are going to be the reserve currency of the world because of things like this and other forces. This just shows me that we're being irresponsible at a time when we shouldn't be, and that we're fighting over things that, in the past never was a thing. I have a friend who's a former congressman who says, look, these were yawn votes. You went in, you spent the money, you voted to raise the debt ceiling, and you went to lunch. It was a yawn vote. Now it's a hostage situation.
That's the first misconception that needs to be corrected, is that this is spending new money. The debt limit is spending that already happened in the past or was approved in the past. This has been going on since 1917. We've been raising the debt limit. And we are now as close as we've almost ever been to going through it. And we don't know what's on the other side, but we know it's going to be bad. We know it's going to be millions of job losses. We know it's going to be a stock market and therefore people's retirement that may go down 30% or more. And those funds have already been suffering from the economy during the pandemic. So we don't want to go there. We don't have to go there because we can borrow the money to continue financing the government. As long as the U.S. remains the reserve currency and our political system is stable, people will happily invest in U.S. treasuries and give us favorable interest rates. We don't have to do any of this. We just have to get our congressional house in order.
Now, they say, I love my conservative friends who like to remind me that economics is like being at the kitchen table. This isn't what we're talking about, though. I can't make money at the kitchen table. I can't, print money to invest in other things and have people give me as you pointed out, favorable rates. But it seems to me that, if I could do this at the kitchen table, the last thing that I would want to do is upset the other people by signaling that I'm not stable. And this is where my frustration in this is. This should not be a thing. And it's my view. I said this from the beginning. Biden should, pursue the 14th Amendment argument, put it at the feet of the Supreme Court, and get rid of this. This should not exist.
Yeah, no other countries really use this mechanism because it's stupid. But let's look at what the Republicans would do if they get their way. They would cut a wide range of government services. Customs and Border Patrol, they say a lot they care about the border. Why do they want to cut the Border Patrol? They say they care about terrorism and Homeland Security. Why cut the Transportation Security Administration, which is already underfunded? We'll have hours-long security lines at airports. If there's a default, we'll have Social Security recipients, Medicare, not getting their payments. So either way, it's a disaster. And what needs to happen now, really, as we've said from the beginning, is move the debt ceiling, move it in a clean manner. There are a few narrow paths still to do that. But otherwise, we could be facing a credit downgrade any day now. And that's going to raise borrowing costs. It's going to raise the deficit. no matter what happens.
So, but I'm looking at this, and I'm a little disheartened by the fact that there's the quote unquote negotiations going on, because the president said no, we're going to raise the debt ceiling. It seems to me that it's you know, heads I win, tails I lose, or you know, however that goes, that even if we do come up with an agreement that cuts all of the things that we're talking about and makes these painful, deep cuts to working people, it's a bad deal. If we default, it's still a bad deal. And it's the people at the bottom, it's the working people who are the ones who get stiffed again. And this is my problem with a lot of these policies, that it's all about, you know, people who show up every day, the ham and eggers who keep this country moving, who are going to end up, you know, taking it on the chin.
In many, many ways. Lose their jobs, higher interest rates for mortgages, lose their retirement funds. That could be looking at us 2 weeks from now. Realistically, it's all 100% avoidable. So now we have a few days left to think, is this the kind of country we want to be? A deadbeat country that doesn't pay its bills, that's a world laughing stock, and people don't want to invest here.
Yeah. What was the last time the U.S. defaulted on anything?
Well, actually, during the War of 1812, the British came into Washington. They burned the White House and they occupied the Treasury. And for a few days, we couldn't pay our bills. But that wasn't self-inflicted. That was the British Redcoats.
So we've never made the choice to not pay our bills. Never. In the history of the country, we've never done this.
And after the Civil War, we always paid our bills. But there was concern about it. And there was concern that if Congress resituated the Southern congressmen, that they would fail to pay the Union's debt. So they passed the 14th Amendment, and it said the public debt shall not be questioned. So we may soon, out of necessity, find out exactly what that amendment means. It seems to mean that we should not have a debt limit, that once Congress has approved the spending, they need to pay for it and issue debt if they need to.
Yeah, but if this works, this is the positive in this, and I always like to look for the positive in things. If this works, when we run up our credit cards, however high we can run them up, I can then just go and say I'm not going to pay them because the federal government doesn't have to pay it. I've got a debt ceiling. I have artificially put a debt ceiling on myself, and the money that I've borrowed from you is far above that. I'm not going to pay it. Will that work?
That's what former President Trump seems to want us to do. He's called for a default. He knows quite a bit about this subject. But I don't think we want to follow his financial model with all of our savings.
Yeah.
So let's raise the debt ceiling now.
So what should people do? I know you guys have got the website up, afge.org/raise the debt ceiling, and we'll get links out on social media how folks can participate in that. But what's the marching order?
Well, there are 18 congressmen who come from Republicans who are from districts that voted for President Biden. So they're vulnerable Republicans. They are the hope. We need five of them to vote for country above party and vote to move the debt ceiling before June 1st. So people need to reach out to those 18. They're in New York and New Jersey and around the country, and tell them that they don't want to lose their savings. They don't want to pay more in mortgage rates. If they're federal workers, they don't want to work without pay. They don't want to see their agencies defunded. They need to contact those members and tell them that the U.S. is not a deadbeat nation and we pay our bills, and this nonsense has got to stop.
Man, with everything going on, this is like the worst time for this kind of stuff to happen, especially as the economy's coming back around, inflation's starting to come a little bit under control. You know, we're starting to move in a positive direction. Things are getting better. People's struggles are getting a little bit less. Slowly but surely, we're getting down the right path. And now you've got these hostage takers. I've called them terrorists, because you don't deal with economic terrorists. But I hope folks will check out the website, afge.org/raise the debt ceiling, participate, and maybe we get this done. But Daniel, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Always good stuff, man.
Thanks. Always good to be on this show, and keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah, let's hope. Daniel Horowitz, he is the deputy director of the legislative department there from the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day that A. Philip Randolph, perhaps the most significant African-American figure in the U.S. labor movement, passed away. He was 90 years old. During World War I, Randolph and Chandler Owen founded the monthly magazine The Messenger in Harlem. From the pages of The Messenger, Randolph called for an end to employment discrimination against black workers. A few years later, sleeping car porters who worked on trains for the Pullman Car Company wanted to form a union. They knew they faced an uphill battle because the Pullman Company was notoriously anti-union. They reached out to A. Philip Randolph, inviting him to lead their effort. Since he did not work for the company, Randolph could not be fired for talking about the union. He accepted the job. It took 12 long years of struggle. But in 1937, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters signed their first union contract. They became the first national black union of the American Federation of Labor. During World War II, Randolph organized a planned march on Washington, calling for an end to discrimination in defense industry employment. He called off the march when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt conceded and issued Executive Order 8802, prohibiting the defense industry from engaging in acts of discrimination. In 1963, Randolph helped to plan another march on Washington, D.C. This march, he did not cancel. The March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom drew 250,000 civil rights supporters to the nation's capital. That day, Randolph shared the podium with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech. A. Philip Randolph fought more than half a century for labor rights, for civil rights, and for dignity.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you got any questions, comments, something on your mind, something I got on your nerves. A lot of people today talking about the higher education and the benefits. And look, I'm right there with you. Talking my kids into going and pursuing a career, be it in the building trades or in a manufacturing capacity, or as far as your talents will take you. And what we should be working on is, how do we lower the costs of higher education? To me, there's a lot of policy work that we should be doing that we're not, because we're too busy fighting over nonsense. This debt ceiling thing is ridiculous. But, hey, it's the leverage that they have. It's the hostage situation that they fantasize about. But this time, I think what's different is I think there are some in the Republican caucus who are saying, look, we want to tank the economy. We want to shoot the hostage. We want to see what happens when everything goes boom. I think there are arsonists among us who want to see the explosion and the fire and the pain and suffering. Because it's not going to be them. And then they go, well, Joe Biden's fault. Joe Biden did that. And you go, no, he just wouldn't give you what is a bad deal also. Because understand, if Biden gives in to everything that they want, let's see, so screw it, you're right, we're going to do everything you want. The working class of this country is going to get major screw job. Just so we can continue to enrich the very wealthy. Now, fortunately, I think we the people are coming around to the reality that side of the aisle is lost their minds. The fact that Trump and Biden in a head-to-head poll put on by Reuters and Ipsos, Biden's up 44-38, a 6-point lead. They also found that 63% of voters were less likely to vote for a presidential candidate who backs heavy restriction on abortion. That's the GOP. They bought this baby. Now, one of the things that my Republican friends used to always say, well, you know, we want to squeeze the quarter till the eagle screams. No earmarks. Well, evidently, what's been found out is five Republicans have broken the no earmark pledge. I remember this was a big deal back in 2011. No earmarks, no walking around money, no none of this stuff, no bringing home the bacon. So I find it interesting that these five, Boebert, Byron Donalds, Lance Gooden, Marjorie Trainwreck, and Andy Harris, all Kook Caucus people, have requested a combination of 45 projects totaling almost $176 million. But you're going, but they're just advocating for their people. No, they're supposed to be against earmarks. And these are people who voted against the infrastructure bill, but they'll be happy to take credit for it. They'll be happy to do, well, they'll be able to cash in on it. And speaking of cashing in, Rudy Giuliani's been taking a beating. And I got to go back to this. Rudy, what were you doing, Rudy? We found out yesterday that he's being sued. He's being sued and accused of rape and sexual harassment and a whole bunch of really creepy stuff. Evidently Rudy had a thing for booze and Viagra. You figure it out. But evidently, he hired this woman basically to be his, I don't know. You think of the word for that, where at his beck and call, she must be naked or in a bikini, while he's erratic and drunken. And, have you ever seen him during some of those press conferences? Yeah. But evidently now the other story is that we're now finding out how much it costs, because evidently Rudy was trying to sell pardons. And he was saying that Trump was offering to sell presidential pardons for $2 million apiece. If there's truth in this, again, I should frame this like Fox News does. We have it on good authority, a whistleblower that we can't find or can't identify has come forth and said that, Rudy sold these pardons and we've got all the information, receipts at five. I don't know, but if these allegations are true, this is kind of a big freaking deal, don't you think? But I've been enjoying the last couple of days of watching right-wing media lose their minds over this Durham report, which is a giant nothing burger. Because again, it means something to me only if you're putting it in front of people in robes, only if you're pulling people in and trying them for crimes and then locking them up. That didn't happen. So for me, this is a good conversation point, because there's a lot of allegations being thrown around on both sides, where, I guess depending on where you get your news is what side of the issue you're on. This is where, going back to my friends reaching out and saying that education is important, this is where education is important. But Rudy got himself in a pickle. Also, I wanted to bring up the dumbest guy in the Senate. Everyone who listens to the show, you do know the dumbest guy in the Senate is Tommy Tuberville. And shame on you, Alabama, for depriving the nation of Doug Jones and bringing us the dumbest guy in the Senate, who evidently he said that Americans should demand an end of democracy. He said the American people should just stand up and say enough is enough. Let's don't have elections anymore. Should I say that again? A sitting U.S. senator, or in this case, he was standing, said the American people should just stand up and say enough is enough. Let's don't have elections anymore. Now, that's not the craziest thing I've heard on the Republican side of the aisle. There was a MAGA speaker at the Trump Hotel. I guess they were warning about highly technological advanced mermaids and water people who are spreading wickedness. And she was calling for hand-to-hand combat. Someone put her on a stage. People sat and listened to this. We need education more than ever. And that's what Trump said. I love the poorly educated. Here we are. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News.